It's great to be here. Sandra and I are very pleased to be here tonight, and we want to thank the book club membership, its excellent staff, its awards committee, and our wonderfully supportive community for this prestigious honor. This ceremony is particularly satisfying for me because of my personal association with Oscar Lewis. Since 1969, I've been good friends with Oscar's grandnephew, William F. Lewis, who arranged for me to visit Oscar at his home on Union Street a few years before he passed away at the age of 99. And it is with great pleasure that we come here tonight to receive an award in Oscar's name in a city that was so central to his life and work and to ours. We will not be showing slides, as we often do, but both Sandra and I will offer a few vignettes of our personal lives. Something you will not find on a colophon page of one of the 60 or so books we've published, and certainly will not find it easily on our website, which we don't need to talk about. That's another story. I normally take an operational view of what I do and teach, but tonight we might also think, if only while we talk here, that emotional communication may be the highest form of information. Let's cut then to 1968. With my political science BA in hand and UC Santa Barbara behind me, I wrongly supposed, that summer I marched off to Hastings College of the Law. A semester later, I knew law school was a mistake, at least for me. Stimulated by the provocative reading lists of my UCSB fraternity brothers, I was in a fraternity, Don Wood, who would later win a Caldecott Award for his children's book, The Napping House, and Judd Fine, who went to Cornell for an MFA in art after graduate studies in history. I quit law school and hitchhiked into my future. 6 months and 300 hitch rides later through the USA, Europe, and North Africa, I returned to California, intending to study poetry and art, but determined to file a conscientious objector and as a conscientious objector with the draft, and continue volunteer draft counseling that had led me to study law. Instead, I stopped in Santa Barbara and did not escape again until 1971, when I received a master's degree in religious studies from UCSB with an emphasis on religious themes in American literature. During those 2 years, I built and lived in a shed-frame shack on a cliff overlooking the ocean, received a high draft lottery number that dismissed my conscientious objector case, but not my deeper sentiments, wrote a few passable poems, and committed myself to a life, even if I could not make a living as an artist. Although I think it may not be true of all younger people today, I made the assumption then that creative work in any form was a kind of progressive political statement. I felt comfortable making things, even though I did not know what I was going to do next or how to do it. I moved to Berkeley, worked as a waiter, sent poems to small magazines, some of which were actually published, saved money, and dedicated myself to poetry. By a miracle, another long story I won't go into, I was accepted into the graduate creative writing program at Brown University. Between 1973 and 1975, I wrote and studied poetry, taught creative writing, learned the rudiments of typography and letterpress printing at Rhode Island School of Design, saw numerous fine press and rare books in the John Hay Library, wonderful place, received an MFA in creative writing, and began to publish modest books of poetry. The pace of life quickened when I arrived at Brown and has not changed since. My most creative professional activity came in 1974 when I established my own imprint, which I unadvisedly called Turkey Press, to design, print, and publish limited edition books of poetry and art. Exactly a year later, an even more profound event occurred, which Sandra will tell you about, which is describes when we met in San Francisco. The artist George Braque believed that cubism brought painting within his capabilities. The commitment that Sandra and I have made to poetry, typography, printing, and making books has brought the fullness of artistic experience within our reach. Even in our most difficult personal and professional moments, that commitment has never deserted us. The press has been the foundation of my creative work and professional maturity, and it has served as the vehicle for understanding the past, developing relationships, and comprehending technological change. More importantly, my experience with editing, printing, and publishing poetry provided the pathway for me to teach, even when I wound up in an art department. In the 1970s, there was no book art field that I knew about. There were no book arts programs then at any college or university. The job I have now at UC Santa Barbara did not exist when I was a student, nor did it exist when I began to teach in 1978. In the 1960s, Marshall McLuhan proclaimed that the new technology turns the old technology into an art form. But few of us in the book arts field now fully understood then how critically important technological change would be for the reception of the work we have made. What I suspected as a young student, and what has become increasingly clear to me over the years, is that the primary importance of poetry and all the arts is what it can add to the individual mind. The title epigram from my 1976 book of poems, one of my only books of poetry, called Unknown Friends, introduces the story of my last 40 plus years. And I quote, "No matter how isolated you are or how lonely you feel, if you do your own things diligently and conscientiously, unknown friends will come to you and seek you out." In 1978, I began teaching the art of the book at UCSB in the College of Creative Studies. The experience of learning to make art while teaching it to students over the past three decades continues to humble and inspire me. By 1996, I was chair of the Department of Art, teaching classes, book art, papermaking, visual literacy, and media ecology that did not exist when I was a student. In the same building I had to sneak into to make raku pots when I was a political science major 30 years earlier. My own personal experience helps explain why I tell students to follow their interests, not their abilities. Poetry and art are hopelessly undervalued or ignored in contemporary American life. But our best students, and some of mine and Sandra's are here tonight with us, who in their own way make the same commitment that we have done, give us more hope for the future of our field than we ever could imagine. They make everything we do together relevant, worthwhile, and important. Flashback, again, this time to 1973. I'm a waiter at Oleg's restaurant in Berkeley. Anyone remembers Oleg? Located on Shattuck Avenue between Serendipity Books on one end and University Avenue on the other. Alan Watts, a British-born philosopher, writer, and public speaker, who is best known as an important interpreter of Eastern philosophy and religious ideas for a Western audience, comes to the restaurant to give a televised interview with a Bay Area station. I am his waiter. Watts draws four Chinese characters with a felt-tip pen on a paper napkin. When I find the napkin on the table after everyone departs, I consider it as my tip. With help from Chinese scholars at Brown, I pieced together a translation that sounds to me as if Alan Watts had spoken it. When I learned to make paper a few years later in Isla Vista, the printing of this calligraphy and translation became one of my first projects. Sandra and I have made more than 1,000 Watts pieces, as we call them, over the last 30 years. That's a large number, by the way, for us. And to celebrate our return to San Francisco, when we finish here, we want each of you to have one to remember this evening. And this is what they look like, okay? I'm not capable of reading the Chinese, but my translation reads, "You discover who you are by acting naturally." I should tell you about a conversation I had with the artist and Dai Chi master Ao Chungliang Wang at Esalen in 1988. As I was showing him some of our books and prints, he saw this small rectangle of handmade paper. And he said, "Oh, that's an Alan Watts there." Startled that he could recognize the brushstrokes of his friend who had been dead for 15 years, I related my story of the napkin and the Berkeley restaurant. Al told me about working with Alan Watts as his calligraphy teacher. He said Alan had been frustrated with his own progress as a calligrapher. Al said to him, "You can practice day and night, and it is possible that instead of a third-rate Chinese calligrapher, you may one day become a second-rate Chinese calligrapher." "I'm not sure that's what I want," Watts told him. "You're right," Al said. "I think we both agree that you should continue to do what you have been doing, what you are doing now. It's much better to be a first-rate Alan Watts." Sandra and I continue what we do, and thank you for your support. Your gift will be waiting for you when we're finished. So thank you.
What an amazing thing this is. Thank you for coming. And just to ensure that I stay on point, I have written everything down. As a friend of ours once said, lack of brevity is a sure sign of insanity. So I'll do my best to heed that warning. I want to thank the book club and those members in particular who have been talking about us behind our collective backs for honoring us with the Oscar Lewis Award. It is always special to be acknowledged by one's peers as having contributed to the greater good of the community. It is all the more touching since it is something for which one cannot audition. I would also like to thank Jonathan Gerken, if he has arrived. Thank you. In particular, a former student of Harry's in the College of Creative Studies and my Turkey Press studio assistant extraordinaire, for printing the beautiful announcement. He not only created a tangible residue of something having actually occurred on this date, but he unwittingly mapped most all the places I have lived in California along the Pacific Rim, west of the West, as Peter Koch calls it. Beginning in San Rafael, migrating slightly north to Inverness on Tomales Bay, heading south to San Mateo, east to Lake Tahoe, then plunging further south to Palos Verdes Peninsula, skipping over an 8-year intermission in Colorado before heading back to San Francisco, where my introduction to the world of books began. Is that better? In October 1975, I was substitute teaching in the San Francisco Unified School District and working nights at the St. Francis Hotel as a cocktail waitress in the Piccadilly Bar, which looked out on Union Square. I was mugged one night on my way home from work and called two friends, Kurt Shaw and Kathy Patterson, who are in the audience tonight, to see if I could stay with them because my roommate, Paul Bellina, also in the house tonight, was on vacation in Hawaii, and I didn't want to stay in the apartment alone. Under the category, how do you know what happens to you isn't good, I was introduced to Harry Reese, who was sitting in the kitchen table, at the kitchen table, celebrating his 28th birthday with dear friends, having recently returned to California after completing a master's program in creative writing at Brown University. By the time he left Providence, he had published 5 or 6 books of poetry under the Turkey Press imprint. I have forgotten who it was that said books and architecture are two of the most familiar art forms that people encounter every day and think nothing of it. But as soon as those forms are moved just slightly off the norm, they become exotic. That night, looking at those modest books of poetry, I had the experience I was looking at something I had never seen before. I was looking at them as tactile, three-dimensional, luminous objects, not so much as books of poetry. I had no history of writing poetry or even reading it. I didn't draw, paint, or make photographs. I had been thrust into my starting point of making books as the result of a fateful encounter with a mugger. I insinuated my way into Harry's life, which started with a reading list: George Seferis, Garcia Lorca, W.S. Merwin, Jack Spicer. I didn't know what to say about what I had read. Harry said, "Don't worry about it. Just read until you come to a memorable line. Hang on to it and continue to the next one." Encouraged by this liberated sensibility to read widely without fear, I ventured into one of the many used bookstores in Berkeley and bought a small book of poems, accompanied by messy ink and charcoal drawings of strange animals. The poet and illustrator was Kenneth Patchen. This was the second time within a few days I had the experience I was looking at something I had never seen before. As the saying goes, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. By a collision of circumstances, the "there" in that sentence began to have a definable shape. Is this a good sound level? Robert Bringhurst writes, in the solid form of language, drop a word in the meaning. Let me start again. Drop a word in the ocean of meaning, and concentric ripples form. now drop two or three words in at once. Interference patterns form, reinforcing one another here and canceling each other there. Bringhurst writes, "This is what it means to listen and to read." I think this is also true of what it means to have a conversation. In 1978, a year after moving to Isla Vista with Harry, I read an article in the Santa Barbara News Press about Morris Mitchell. He was stepping down from his position as the director of the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions in Santa Barbara. The article mentioned in passing that he was also interested in fine press books. I knew him as chancellor of the Denver University when I was a student there from 1965 to 1969. I wrote a letter to him saying how much I admired a speech he gave on the Denver campus, surrounded by the National Guard, in solidarity with the students against the war in Vietnam. "And by the way," I wrote, "my husband and I print and publish small editions of poetry in our studio at home." It was only when we visited his home that we discovered the depth of our shared interests. He had not only a standing order with the Allen Press, he had a working studio of presses and type, including a full cabinet of uninked Stempel, Palatino, and Augustea, all of which was given to him when he retired as chairman of the board of Encyclopedia Britannica. He was recovering from triple bypass surgery and no longer had the stamina to print. By the end of the day, Harry was negotiating the donation of his shop to the College of Creative Studies. One of the advantages of living in the student-dominated community of Isla Vista is the proximity to the university. There is a constant influx of visitors with stories to tell a bike ride away. In 1985, James Lachlan, publisher of New Directions, came to UCSB to talk about William Carlos Williams. We invited him to visit the press. He said he was sorry, but his wife loved to play the Sandpiper golf course that runs along the ocean near us, and they couldn't visit. During the next year, I learned to play golf. When Lachlan returned the following spring to talk about the life and work of the Trappist monk, Thomas Merton, we joined him and his wife, Anne, in a foursome at Sandpiper. In between holes, waiting to tee off, Lachlan told us one story after another, from identifying Dylan Thomas in the morgue to filling the encyclopedic mind of James Joyce with Pennsylvania place names and Lachlan family genealogy. The conversation continued, and before we started the back nine, he had given us permission to publish Ezra Pound's Cathay, a small volume that contains some of the most moving poems we've ever read. To make a long story ironic, we still haven't published Cathay, although we plan to get right at it. But we did have the pleasure to edit, print, and publish three books of Lachlan's own poetry, as well as Thomas Merton's previously unpublished Alaskan Journal. Anyone who makes books knows that the finished book object is something like an exotic fish that emerges out of a vast coral reef of accreted conversations. Memory creates the future as well as the past. The books Harry and I have made together over the past 38 years circulate in the world without us. As finished artifacts, they may generate conversations of their own. The conversations that brought them into being remain with us. The memorable lines are there for new readers to discover. I'll read a line from Michael Hannon's poem, The Sea Gazer. After an hour, the room is changed, not so much by light as by the entrance and dismissal of thought. Thank you.